Recorded live in downtown Newtown, this is Rancho Notorious, a podcast about movies and other cool stuff. You can find this and all the other episodes of the show at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious. I was so into that music that I completely forgot that I had to continue talking. welcome everybody to season 1, episode 12. Can't believe it, a dozen. Episode 12 of Rancho Notorious. I'm Dan Slavin and I'm alone in the studio, and it's not evening. This is actually like a breakfast show here in New Zealand. Kaylee Carruthers, you're on location. Please tell us where you are.
I am in the hallway of my hostel in downtown Chicago.
Downtown Chicago.
the quietest place I can find. So I apologize for the echo, but this is the best I can do right now.
Look, there's no need to apologize because this is simply the miracle of, what can I say? The miracle of modern technology that allows us to talk at all. This is, as I say, 7 o'clock in the morning, New Zealand time, or roughly 20 past 7, actually, now that we've got started recording. I've got my cup of Joe here in front of me. And what time is it in Chicago?
It is 2:22 p.m., just after a lovely lunch from the Corner Bakery, just down the road.
So, yeah. All right. And look, we'll talk a little bit more about your adventures in the United States a little bit later on. But first off, we should introduce the show properly. On today's show, we find out what you've been up to overseas, and we both get to review. This is actually, you know, going to be our first shared review on the show. Richard Linklater's Oscar-tipped Boyhood and the authorized documentary about Nick Cave, 20,000 Days on Earth. All of that plus the usual, you know, glut of news, stats, opinion, etc., etc. Kaylee, what is in the mailbag?
Yes, well, from Claire Corvey, one of our, I believe she's one of our executive producers.
She is.
Also known as Claire.comedy. Frank, the film is well worth seeing. My two-word review for Rancho Podcast is Fassbender Fascinates, and I have to agree with her on that one.
I haven't seen Frank yet. Sorry about that.
Oh, it's a good one. It's a good one. Fred Thompson, our favorite. Two-word review for The Inbetweeners 2, Lewd and Crude, takes things to the cringeworthy extreme, but I did lull once or twice. Maybe more.
Yep. Well, I'm good on him for even giving it a go. That would have been beyond me.
And from Rebecca McMillan, also known as Pomo, I would love to win that Glenn Kenny book. My fave De Niro film has to be the Deer Hunter, captivating, powerful, electric. I think she may have just won the book.
I think so. I think that the judges have decided that that entry is worthy of the book. It is also, not that this is a factor in our decision-making at all, but the fact that she is in Wellington and we are in Wellington and the book is in Wellington, or at least I am in Wellington and the book is in Wellington, makes it kind of easy to deliver it to you. So Rebecca McMillan of Wellington, that copy of the book by Glenn Kenny, Robert De Niro, Anatomy of an Actor, will be winging its way to you, probably by hand at some point, sometime during next week. And if you want to know more about that book, you can go back through our archives to listen to the interview with Glenn Kenny from an earlier episode. I'm not even sure which one it is now. And also, if you're interested in The Inbetweeners, Darren Bevan gave us a very special interview with two of the stars of The Inbetweeners, which was featured in last week's show.
Mm-hmm.
So that's our mailbag.
Yeah, we're a short mailbag today.
Awesomeness. So what have people been watching at the movies this week in New Zealand?
Ooh, let's see. Opening at number 5, If I Stay. Opening at number 4, The Inbetweeners 2. Sitting at number 3, The 100-Foot Journey.
If I Stay, is that still playing in the US? Is that one of those ones that opened everywhere around the same time?
Yeah, it's still playing in the US.
Right.
I think it opened maybe a week earlier in the States.
Right.
Maybe.
It's a weepy. It's one of those weepies, isn't it, that we've people have been talking about a lot. And interesting that that it hasn't actually opened it higher, I would have thought. Maybe it's is it based on a book that might, or not based on a book, that would be, you know, if it doesn't have an inbuilt audience for it.
I think it is based on a book.
Well, then it's a failure. Damn it. It's a flop. I'm calling it now.
Sitting at number two, Guardians of the Galaxy, and still in the number one spot, Lucy.
Very well done. Showing that women action stars can absolutely tame the box office. There was a story in one of the New Zealand newspapers the other day about how Hollywood is manufacturing these weepies and how there's a science to the structure of these films and how they know exactly how to provoke, using editing and music cues and what have you, exactly how to provoke tears at exactly the moment that they want them. And they know that audiences nowadays really want to have those emotions provoked. And there was a it was really interesting how they pointed out that men and women both want to feel those emotions but want to feel them very differently. Women want to cry all the way through a movie, and men want a kind of cathartic release at the end of a movie, and that they're structuring films now to try and provide both or satisfy both requirements. It was interesting that a consultant on the film, Captain Phillips, you saw Captain Phillips, didn't you?
Yes.
Yeah, and how that film built to a cathartic release at the end, and that was pretty much, you know, a technical process in order to make sure that the guys watching got the kind of the flood of tears that that they sort of needed after all that tension. It certainly worked on me.
Yeah, it worked on me. I was crying.
Indeed.
But not through the whole thing.
But not through the whole thing. Yeah. Well, that's right. Maybe you're a man. So. Australia, let's just have a look at Australia moving right along. Number five, straight in at number five, first week, Magic in the Moonlight, the new Woody Allen film, which also has the highest screen average. If I Stay, opening at number four in Australia. And number three, The 100-Foot Journey, much the same as everywhere else, actually, although they got Lucy earlier than us, and therefore it's dropped further down. It's now at number six. Number two in Australia, The In-Betweeners 2. And that's the thing about The In-Betweeners 2 in Australia, is that it's like an Australian film, because even though it's a British TV show, they are in Australia for that particular film. So it's got a lot of local interest. Number one, after 4 weeks, Guardians of the Galaxy, still going strong in Australia. And do you have the US figures in front of you? Did I send you those?
Yes, I do. At number five, As Above, So Below, opens in that position. Let's Be Cops at number four. If I Stay at three, and to answer our question, it's the second week in release in the US for If I Stay. Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles staying steady at two, and Guardians of the Galaxy holding down that number one spot with just a weekend gross of almost $23 million.
Holy smokes.
And that's week number five.
Right. And Guardians of the Galaxy now officially the biggest film of the summer in the US, although I think in international terms the Transformers movie still holds the flag. But Guardians of the Galaxy, yeah, and there's lots of debate online about, you know, whether this means, you know, what this means for summer movies, because it's actually been a fairly dismal summer, even though there's been quite a lot of big hits, a lot of fairly average results as well. So I think average box office down about 15% across the whole summer in the US, which is a big problem. Just dropping back to Australia for a moment, I forgot to mention that we're going to be looking very closely at the box office next week in Australia, because what we do in the shadows, the Wellington filmed New Zealand made vampire movie opens there this weekend, and I know social media has been full of all of the appearances by Taika Waititi, and Rhys Darby is doing a lot of media in Australia for that film as well. They have been everywhere, those guys. I mean, I know that in New Zealand we were swamped by what we do in the shadows marketing and media, and it contributed to a massive, massive box office take for an independently released movie. They're repeating that pattern in Australia. Like, those guys are on every radio show. They're on every TV show. I'm fascinated to see what the impact of that will be when next week's box office comes out.
And also, interestingly, I'm going to go watch that at TIFF because I didn't get a chance to see it in Wellington because I was busy working for the festival.
Right.
So I am traveling to Toronto to watch What We Do in the Shadows.
Yeah, to go and watch a movie made in Wellington. Yep, that's the way of the world.
And I'll probably be laughing the loudest out of everyone there, and it'll be embarrassing for me, but it'll be wonderful.
Also at TIFF, The Deadlands, which launched their website this week, and lots of excitement about that movie, Tara Fraser's new film. And do you know if you're going to be able to see that one as well?
I don't think so. A friend of mine has purchased us tickets. I did put that on the can we please watch this list, but I think I'm there too late to see it.
Ah, right.
Because I'm only there for the last 4 days. So all the world premieres happen in the first week, and everything that is just a North American premiere gets bumped to the second week. So there was some interesting news coming out of Telluride about that, actually. So,
well, talking of Telluride, I think it's time to find out what you were doing last week. Last time we spoke, you'd basically just arrived in Telluride. You'd had some orientation, but you hadn't seen any screenings, and the celebs hadn't arrived. You've got some guests making their
Sorry,
way.
Sorry, there's some really loud people walking down the hall.
That's all right. We understand what it's like. It's giving us a flavour of the real America. So tell us about Telluride.
Oh, where to start? Okay, I'll just start by saying that Dan Slevin and I now belong to a group of the most irritating people on earth, I think.
Yep.
Oh my gosh, Dan, it was even better than I thought it would be. Like, it completely blew my mind. Like, if there's a heaven for film lovers, it is Telluride. And I remember before I left, you told me that when you left Telluride, you actually cried.
Yeah.
I took the train from Grand Junction to Chicago, which was about 27 hours, and I was sitting on that train feeling so sad. It was like I'd been dumped. Like, that's how I felt.
Yeah.
I felt like I was leaving behind some, like, great relationship.
There's something magical about that place as well. Like, it's not just the fact that you're surrounded by film people and film. I mean, I'm sure after maybe, I don't know, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 years, you would get bored with the landscape. But you know, if you lived there, wouldn't you just have such a placid, chilled out, relaxed attitude to life? Can you imagine not being happy in a place like that?
Yeah, well, I found some of the locals were the ones who were a lot less blissed out by the whole experience, just because I think they were a bit miffed by all these people coming into town. Oh my gosh, I was in such a state of bliss the whole time that I always had a smile on my face, which was great because it made me really good at my job. Because the main part of, because I went there as, for those who haven't caught up or forgotten, I went there as staff. So I was working at the Chuck Jones Cinema, which is in Mountain Village. So I was up above Telluride. And there's only sort of one cinema up there. So we're sort of up on our own little island in Mountain Village at Chuck Jones. And I was doing concessions. So I was scooping popcorn and getting drinks and serving people and just chatting with people, making coffee, stuff like that. And yeah, I just, the whole part of being staff is they tell you, like, you're representing the festival. So you have to treat everyone like the best as you possibly can. And there's different levels of passes based on how much support they're giving, if they're a sponsor. And so you get this booklet called the Vespucci, and has all this information in it. And so you just sort of memorize all these colored passes and know who to bow down to and, you know, who goes where. But really, I just treated everyone the same. I basically treated everyone like they were a major sponsor in the show circle. And I just, yeah, it was amazing. And the staff, everyone I worked with was amazing. I got 2 job offers just from being nice to people at concessions. And my manager told me that he's recommended me for assistant manager for concessions at Chuck Jones next year. So that's
pretty
good. It's pretty pretty good.
God damn it. Well, how long was the shift? Like, I know because because it's a very short festival, it's only 4 days of actual sort of formal screenings. They start really early in the morning and finish quite quite late at night. So what shift were you on?
I was on the morning shift, so I worked, most shifts were 8 or 8.5 hours, so I worked 7 a.m. until about 2 or 3, depending when the film went in the afternoon. So, the best part about that was all the tribute screenings that happened at Chuck Jones were in the morning, first thing. So I got to go to 3 tribute screenings, which was amazing. And the tribute screenings are every year, 3 directors or actors are chosen as tributes and they get awarded medals. And there's screenings that, it's a screening of either one of their new films or in the case of Francis Ford Coppola, they've screened Apocalypse Now, the original version. And they get presented with a medal and there's a Q&A and sort of this montage of everything they've worked on beforehand. And they're just fantastic. Absolutely.
They are amazing experiences. The medal part is always a little bit weird because that just, you know, it seems kind of vaguely sort of ancient Greek or something to do something like that. But the year I went, 2012, it was Mads Mikkelsen, Marion Cotillard, and
everyone was talking about the Mads Mikkelsen tribute year.
Right. He was great. He was really good. It was a fantastic interview with him. And Roger Corman was the other tributee, and I got to one of the I missed the first screening of that, the first of those sessions, and got to that early morning one at the Chuck Jones, which was hosted by Leonard Maltin. And I mean, it was just a brilliant conversation between Leonard Maltin and a nearly 90-year-old Roger Corman about the history of the movies, and then a documentary about him. It was absolutely fantastic.
This year, the tributes were Francis Ford Coppola with Apocalypse Now, or sort of a look back on Apocalypse Now. Hilary Swank with The Homesman, the new film directed by Tommy Lee Jones, which I did get to watch, which was awesome. And also a tribute to Volker Schlondorf, who directed Diplomacy. So there's an NZIF sort of double up there. I didn't end up going into that one, but I did serve him coffee, so I felt pretty good about that.
Yeah, well, fantastic. I mean, you made his day.
I was hoping he'd ask if he had to pay, but he didn't. He just took the cup and was like, oh, yeah, of course I don't have to pay. I was like, oh, okay.
Yeah, I mean, the free cup of coffee has got to be better than a gold medal any day. Apocalypse Now, that was interesting because it wasn't just Coppola who was there for that. John Milius, who wrote the screenplay, was there, and there were a whole lot of the people who were involved in that.
But yeah, the whole creative team were there, and just listening to them talk was absolutely inspiring and incredible. And the funny thing was that Francis Ford Coppola was actually 20 minutes late because he was stuck on the gondola. So they didn't even have a shuttle for the guests to come up in. Like, they literally, like, he was just stuck on the gondola because it had broken down when he was on his way up.
But that's one of the most amazing things about the festival, isn't it? That everybody, you know, gets around the same way. So if you're going up or down to a screening, the chances, there's a very good chance that you will be sitting in a gondola with 5 other people, one of whom is an Academy Award winning filmmaker. And you've got and it's what? It's a 15-minute gondola ride. So you're almost obliged to make conversation. Like, you can't, it's not like you bump into a celebrity somewhere and you just sort of look down at your feet and ignore them and try and treat them like they're not the celebrities they are. You're just human beings stuck in a glass box. So you have to have a conversation, or people listen to your accent and go, where are you from? And conversations start that way. Christian Petzold, who made Barbara, he was one of the guests when I was there, and he said he turned up for a Q&A that I was at, and he said, look, I've already done 3 of these today in the gondola. You know, people just keep asking him questions, and it was just extraordinary. What did you learn about Apocalypse Now that you perhaps didn't know before?
I don't know, because it was such, it was almost like an informal conversation. I think the most exciting part was actually listening to the cinematographer speak about his craft and, you know, the decisions they made and how they did it. And he's just so eloquent and just, yeah, the way he talks about cinematography, like he just, you know, he wakes up in the morning and he's looking through, you know, his, like a camera lens, and it's, oh, it was just like, my brain was melting. It was so good. I didn't end up watching the film because it was quite early. And I think that was on my sort of first morning shift. So I wasn't quite up to experiencing the Vietnam War at 8:30 in the morning. But I did pop in for the discussion afterwards, which was really lovely.
It was interesting that they actually screened the original version, didn't they? Not the Redux version.
Yes. Oh yeah. And that's the most interesting thing. That's the most interesting thing I learned about Apocalypse Now is, Apocalypse Now Redux was born out of Francis Ford Coppola being in a hotel room one night and Apocalypse Now came on and he's like, oh, okay, I guess I'll watch it. Realizing it wasn't that crazy as they first thought and was like, well, I guess I can put those scenes back in that I thought were a bit too much. Literally, that is how Apocalypse Now Redux was made. Francis Ford Coppola watched it and was like, that's not so bad. And then did the director's cut.
Turn it up to 11.
Pretty much.
Yeah. So, were there any other highlights in terms of films that you got to see? Because if your shift started so early, that meant you would have been knocking off work at about mid afternoon or something to go and hang out at the movies elsewhere.
Yeah, it worked out pretty well because the Chuck Jones is one of the larger cinemas, so we could usually get into screenings. Not all the time, but most of the time we could squeeze in the back somewhere, or sometimes at the front. I think everything I saw I really liked. I was really glad I got to see Foxcatcher because I was looking forward to that for several months. It was very, very enjoyable.
That's Steve Carell and
Channing Tatum.
So was Channing Tatum in Telluride?
He was, and foolishly in that screening, I decided to take seats for viewing rather than for the Q&A because it wasn't listed as a Q&A. But at Telluride, if there's a screening, the cast and crew and the director, if they're there, will probably show up just to intro the film. And they did. So, yeah, that was my closest encounter to Channing Tatum, aside from little girls running around screaming, asking where Channing Tatum was. Like, I don't know. But apparently he got mobbed by young girls and had to sort of make an escape. So unfortunately I didn't see him, but I did see Gael Garcia Bernal a few times.
He was there my year as well, yeah.
Yeah, I think the year that you went, he went to the staff party as well.
Right.
So I got all these like awesome stories about Gael Garcia Bernal. So we're all hoping he would like come to the to the staff party and like have a go on the dance floor, but he didn't come this year. So, but he was there with Jon Stewart's first film, Rosewater, which was surprisingly, not surprising. There's quite a bit of buzz around it, but it was really funny and a really, really wonderful film. I thought it'd be quite dark, but it was fantastic. It was really good. So.
Yeah, that's one I'm looking forward to.
Yeah, definitely. And I was also really surprised by Wild, starring Reese Witherspoon. I thought it might be a little bit too Eat, Pray, Love, but it was really great. And I think I really connected with it because, well, you know, not the part of her being addicted to heroin and breaking up with her partner, but just being a woman traveling on her own, like doing her own thing. And so I definitely connected to that film and really enjoyed it. But I sort of saw the back of Reese Witherspoon's head. That was about the most that I saw of her. So, yeah.
Yeah, the year that I was there, I saw the back of Greta Gerwig. A little bit more. She was around for a while with Noah Baumbach and. The name of that film's just escaped me for a little while. You know, the black and white one. The one that we all like. Yeah, that one.
Yeah.
But also there was a screening that I went to that Dennis Quaid was in attendance at. And he was standing around outside while I walked out of that screening after the Q&A. And it was the only time I think that I actually made eye contact with somebody like really like super famous. And he just, we just like made eye contact as I went out. And, you know, that was a moment where, you know, it's like, oh, that person who's just looked at me, that's Dennis Quaid, and he's about a foot shorter than I thought he would be. First of all, it's an amazing place, an amazing experience. And so you're going back next year?
Yeah, well, hopefully, even if I'm just volunteering, I'm definitely going back next year. I sort of fell in love with the Chuck Jones cinema, and all the crew there was so amazing. I just can't wait to go back, and I don't really want to be at any of the other cinemas. I just want to be up on the mountain at Chuck Jones on our little island up there. It was great. I think one of my favorite surprises actually was The Imitation Game. It's probably going to get quite a wide release. It's the story of Alan Turing, who invented the computer, basically the first computer.
Right, that's Cumberbatch, isn't it?
It is Cumberbatch. He was supposed to be at the Q&A but didn't show up. But the director was there, and I didn't realize it was the director of Headhunters. So I got to sit in a Q&A, like right at the front, with Todd McCarthy interviewing the director of Headhunters, and it was awesome. And then it turned out that his wife also helped him direct it, and she was sitting right behind me. So that was a very cool, like, I am sandwiched between all these really amazing people right now moment. Mm. So.
Fantastic, fantastic. Look, I can't wait to see your photographs. I'm going to assume you took a lot of photographs when you get back. We need to move on with the show, because all the people that are really, really irritated by us talking about Telluride have tuned out by now.
Yeah.
So maybe it's we should talk about a film that's actually playing here in Wellington as opposed to a film that isn't. So time to listen to some Nick Cave.
What do you fear the most? It does worry me that I'm not going to be able to continue to do what I do and reach a place that I'm satisfied with.
In a sense?
Because memory is what we are. Your very soul and your very reason to be alive is tied up in memory. Those moments when the gears of the heart really change.
Should we stop there?
I'm transforming.
20,000 Days on Earth, that is a kind of authorized biography of Nick Cave, authorized documentary, and played at NZIF, and that means that, Kayleigh, you would have got to see it either in advance of that because you were staff or during the festival, am I right?
It was definitely not an advanced screening, but I was very lucky. I got to go to one of the sold out screenings at the embassy, and it was amazing. I just remember everybody clapping after the intro, like the film hadn't even started. It was just like the intro opening credits, and people just burst into applause once that title came up.
So that's 750 Nick Cave fans, right? All watching their hero being sort of unraveled and unveiled in front of them.
Mm.
I just got to see it this weekend, and I was a little bit disappointed with it, actually. Maybe the build up had been too big. I'm not a huge Nick Cave fan, so I was sort of hoping for more. I like Nick Cave, but I don't know everything about him, so I was hoping for a little bit more information. And because it's a film that doesn't actually, it's not a documentary in the sense that it guides you through this person's life in a kind of narrative sense, you know. It's and a lot of what goes on is kind of constructed, and you're not sure whether it's not only is the scene in front of you real, but also is even what they're talking about real. Like it's a kind of mythologizing of Nick Cave more than a kind of an educational guide to his life and career.
Yeah, and that's, I think I don't know much about Nick Cave. I sort of listened to his music at summer camp. One of my coworkers was really into it, but I always found him like really sort of mysterious and eerie and creepy, sort of like grim fairy tales put to music, but even darker. So yeah, it took me watching 20,000 Days on Earth, it took a little while because I was expecting it to be a little bit more biographical, but it was very stylized. I don't want to say contrived because that seems negative, but it was very stylized. And sort of once I got into it and sort of just went along for the ride, it was very entertaining, but I did feel a little bit manipulated, you know, because like obviously Nick Cave is behind the wheel on this and he's sort of telling his life in a certain way, but There was quite a bit
in a very Nick Cavey way, I would have thought.
Yeah, yeah. It was very Nick Cavey. That's my two-word review, Nick Cavey.
There are long sections where he's driving around Brighton in a car that may or may not be his actual car, a big black Jaguar, and various people from his life share this drive with him. They sort of appear in the car and they have conversations, and you don't know whether these are figments of his imagination or what, or, you know, what's the contrivance there? People like Ray Winstone turn up, and Kylie Minogue as well. And but I found a little bit frustrating is that nobody in the film is captioned, so nobody gets introduced in terms of their name, and there's no sort of concession to those people who don't know anything about Nick Cave, about who they are. Like there's a section of this car ride with this kind of stern German guy.
Yeah, who was that?
Well, who was that? I mean, I sort of had to work it out by kind of inference that was Blixa Bargeld, who used to be in the birthday party in the Black Seeds and is no longer. But like, you wouldn't. I mean, I don't know if. Yeah, I found that sort of to be almost willfully obstructive to understanding of what was going on. But my companion at that screening, who knew even less about Nick Cave than I did, actually enjoyed it more because she just went on the ride with this story and treated it almost as if, you know, I think appreciated it more like a kind of semi-fictional less as a documentary, whereas I, knowing a little bit about Nick Cave, wanted all the gaps filled in my knowledge. So, you know, it is one of those things that could be really much more satisfying the less you know, or the more you know. And I was sort of stuck in the middle there a wee bit.
Mm. Yeah, it's definitely not a VH1 Behind the Music. It's almost like a semi-biographical music video type thing, because it's what the directors are known for, is doing music videos and sort of behind the scenes documentaries. And this is their first, I think this is their sort of first big feature that they've done. But yeah, I definitely just, I mean, I was all in the festival hype. I think it was it was earlier in the festival, the screening I went to. So it was just, yeah, and being surrounded by Nick Cave fans was just, it was great. It was just a wonderful atmosphere to watch it in.
Yeah, and actually there were quite a few Nick Cave fans at the screening that I was at as well, and you definitely got the sense that they were tapping their feet along to the music. Not as much music as I would have thought. An extended version of Higgs Boson Blues from the recording session. So basically all of that, some live stuff at the end. But yeah, again, an assumption I think that you would already know the music, that there's no need to sort of win you over musically. So, comparing it to the Pulp documentary that also played at New Zealand International Film Festival, I found it more frustrating and probably less satisfying. It made me want to go and find out more about Nick Cave and maybe listen to. I mean, I've never been a big fan of the Birthday Party; they're always a bit too punky for me. So maybe that was a good thing that they didn't play too much of that. So, are you gonna stand by your two words there?
Yeah, I think that's the best I can do for now based on travel and time differences.
No, fair enough. Look,
that's pretty weak for my like first two-word review, but I'm just going to go. I'm going with that.
Okay, my two words are forgotten dreams.
Nice. Director of Once Were Warriors, Lee Tamahori, hasn't made a film in New Zealand since then, as his career took off and he ended up making Bond films like Die Another Day. He wants to return home, though, and has launched an innovative crowdfunding scheme to raise the cash to make The Patriarch, an adaptation of Witi Imahara's novel Bully Basha, using the crowd equity scheme Snowball Effect. Unlike crowdfunding schemes like Pledge Me that help get this very show off the ground, and thank you very much to all of our pledgers, just, you know, plug that in there.
Yeah.
Crowd equity gives givers a real stake of the project, a share of the profits. You can find out more about The Patriarch in the show notes.
Yeah, well, Once Were Warriors actually did make quite a bit of money for the people who invested in it, and I think they're hoping that lightning will strike twice. Of course, you know, movie producing is fraught with risk. So I think anybody wanting to put their money into this, their first priority has to be that they just want to see the film made. And any profits would be a bonus, I would imagine. But, you know, it's an interesting way to certainly get a lot of attention for the production of a film, but also, to get that funding over the edge there.
Mm. New York audiences have the chance to see all three films in Peter Jackson's epic Lord of the Rings trilogy with a live orchestra laying Howard Shore's score in April next year when the Lincoln Center, normally home to another kind of ring cycle, hosts the 21st Century Symphony Orchestra and Chorus of Lucerne, some 250 players and singers.
Yeah, those guys have done that in Lucerne once already, and I get the feeling that this is going to travel all over the world. That wouldn't surprise me if at some point in the next few years we get the New Zealand Symphony Orchestra doing this at the Michael Fowler Centre or something like that in Wellington, or you know, some kind of big deal where you get to hear those stirring strings.
So is it going to be all at once, or is it like three nights?
That's a very good question. No, that would be just too much, wouldn't it? I mean, that's like...
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it must be over three nights.
That's a lot of tear-jerking strings right there.
Mm-hmm.
And Dwayne The Rock Johnson, which hilariously, actually, someone on the train was saying that, yeah, I read on Facebook that he died. So, you know, there you go.
Don't trust anything that you read
on Facebook. Don't trust anything you hear on Amtrak. Dwayne The Rock Johnson has announced that he has sided with the DC Universe in the battle between comic book titans. He will play villain or anti-hero Black Adam in the new Shazam movie, which I'm assuming is different than the Shaquille O'Neal version. The person to play the Shazam himself has yet to be announced.
Yeah, Shazam has always has been... As comic book heroes go, Shazam is one of the weirdest. So it'll be very interesting to see what they actually do with this. But at least they've got a big deal hero there to carry the weight of that film, at least half of the weight of that film on their shoulders. The name of the character is interesting. I'm wondering whether there was any discussion about some maybe. Changing the name of that character to in the same way that Peter Jackson's thinking about changing the name of the dog in the Dam Busters. Anyway, looking at home video today in New Zealand, at least, being released this weekend. So if you missed them at the movie theatres, you can now get them on download or at your local video store. Grand Budapest Hotel this weekend. Monuments Men, which was a little bit of a disappointment, I have to say. Chef, which is probably... I think there'll be a lot of people tempted to take Chef home because it's got a sort of cute mop-headed kid in it, and it looks like it could be sort of family entertainment, and then they're going to get the shock of their lives when the swearing starts. But it is, you know, set in a kitchen, so there's a lot of language in there, and smoking as well, which is also kind of true to life for a kitchen. But yeah, not sure if it's going to play to families quite as well as people think. And also The Invisible Woman, which is the Charles Dickens biography that was made by Ralph Fiennes, which I missed in my sort of sabbatical 6 months that I had at the beginning of the year. Did you see The Invisible Woman by any chance?
No, I did not. I've pretty much only seen festival films for the last 6 months. except for Guardians of the Galaxy the other week.
All right, talking of festival films, time for Boyhood.
Talk to me. Samantha, how was your week? I don't know, Dad, it was kind of tough. Billy and Ellen broke up, and Ellen's kind of mad at me because she saw me talking to Billy in the cafeteria. And you remember that sculpture I was working on? Well, it was a unicorn, and the horn broke off, so now it's a zebra, okay? But I still think I'm going to get an A, right? Mason, how was your week? Well, Dad, you know, it's kind of tough. Joe, he's kind of a jerk. Actually, he stole some cigarettes from his mom. He wanted me to smoke them. But I said no, because I knew what a hard time you had quitting smoking, Dad. How about that? Is that so hard?
Dad, these questions are kind of hard to answer.
What is so hard to answer about what sculpture are you making?
It's abstract.
Okay, that's good. See, I didn't know that. I didn't know you were even interested in abstract art.
I'm not. They make us do it.
But Dad, I mean, why is it all on us though? You know, what about you? How was your week? You know, who do you hang out with? Do you have a girlfriend? What have you been up to?
I see your point. So we should just let it happen more natural, right? That's what you're saying. Okay, that's what we'll do. Starting now.
12 years in the making, this is Richard Linklater's, I guess it's epic, isn't it? In terms of scope, not so much in terms of scale. Yeah.
It's epic. Yeah.
Kaylee, Boyhood was another one that was a very, very successful screening at the New Zealand International Film Festival. What did you make of it?
Well, actually, it's interesting because when I was in Vancouver, I flew into Vancouver before heading off on my festival journey. I met up with a friend of mine and we discussed Boyhood, and we actually had the same opinion on it. And she was the first person that I talked to who liked it but wasn't won over by it. And she summed it up beautifully, saying, you know, if I was male, I think I would really identify with it the way that people have been reviewing it. But because I'm female, I identified more with Lorelai Linklater's character because I sort of felt more connected to what she was going through. And I think that summed it up really well. Boyhood was one of the ones I got to watch a little bit early. And yeah, everyone in the office was raving about it. And I was, you know, like, yeah, it was good, but I wasn't blown away by it. But I think the more I read about it and the more research I did on it and the more time I did sit with it, it became much more impressive in scope. I mean, you know, shooting a film over 12 years with the same cast is quite incredible. But yeah, I'm not as in love with it as everyone else is, but I do definitely appreciate it because I do really like his films. But I think I like his Before and After series a little bit better because, yeah, it has that sort of 10-year space in between them where the characters really do grow and they come back together and they write it. So, yeah, I was impressed by it, but I wasn't enamored by it.
I think to a degree, you sort of have to put to one side how difficult it would have been to make or what an extraordinary achievement it is to make, you know, like that's only part of the story. You still have to judge effectively what's up there on screen, and does the fact that we're watching real characters or real actors growing old in their roles, does it add anything to a story that, let's say, it had been shot in 12 weeks rather than 12 years with maybe a kid actor or actors changing in the roles of the kids, you know, was that story good enough? Was that story interesting enough? Or was it just about the sheer, you know, like you're looking through someone's family album and watching them grow?
Yeah, I think it's more of the family album aspect. So I think that's really the point of the exercise, is that that everyone is growing older. And you do get to see them sort of develop and their attitudes change and, you know, the things they do change. If it was shot in 12 weeks using different actors, which is sort of the standard model, it would be, you know, one of those tearjerker films, and it wouldn't feel quite as...
Because there's not that much of a story there, is there, really?
No, but there is a real, like, authenticity to it, I think. Because I think it's sort of scripted, but it was not, you know, it just sort of went with the flow, which is, I think, sort of how Richard Linklater likes to direct, just sort of like, okay, well, we're going to talk about this and just go there. So yeah, it's one of those films to me. I think I enjoy the practice of it more than the sort of story and performances in it, if that makes sense.
Yeah, it felt to me like I was expecting it to sort of ring me out. Like, from all the things that I had read about Boyhood and the responses to it, I had assumed that this was going to be the kind of film that really just gave me a terrible flogging, and that it would be emotionally charged. And you know, it doesn't take much to actually sort of send me over the edge at movies, despite what the Hollywood crying technicians would have you believe. But I found myself not as moved as I was expecting to, partly because it actually doesn't go into those really the really dark emotional places. And it, because it's kind of episodic and that they go back every year or so, in narrative terms, a lot of the more traumatic stuff that happens to that family happens while the cameras aren't there, if you know what I mean. Like, if it was a documentary, you would assume that, you know, the camera's coming in to ask them about stuff that had happened while the cameras weren't there. And so in that sense, you're watching the aftermath of stuff rather than the most highly fraught dramatic moment. And in some ways, that's really good. Like, it also makes no concessions in much the same way that the Nick Cave film we talked about earlier on. It doesn't make any concessions to you. You have to pay close attention to what's going on. There are no captions that say this is 2005, this is 2007. And, you know, at one point there's a lovely transition where Mason, the kid, goes up the stairs. At the end of one scene, goes up the stairs to his bedroom, and then they cut, and he comes down the stairs, and it's a year later. And but it takes a little moment to work out what's changed. His hair's different. He's, you know, he's got a little spottier or whatever. And I liked the fact that you had to do quite a lot of work as an audience to fill in those gaps. But in some ways, it felt to me like the really dramatic stuff happened off screen. You mentioned earlier on that you felt like you didn't identify so much with Mason's character, but with his older sister. And it was interesting that I, you know, despite being male, I didn't really identify with Mason either. I was, you know, my stage of life was more likely to identify with Ethan Hawke's character, his father. Also, Patricia Arquette's character, the mother, who I thought had the most interesting, you know, in many ways, the most interesting story going on there. But I didn't really buy Ethan Hawke's character. I think that was possibly the thing that sort of held me back with the film, is that his arc, his transitions seemed to me to be more necessary for a film story than actually sort of authentic in terms of what a real human being might do.
Yeah, because he's the absent father, so he just sort of drops in and is like super friendly and takes them bowling and takes them out for dinner and then disappears again. So I think it's also that we just don't get any of his story. And so it seems, yeah, he doesn't seem realistic because we don't actually know who he is.
He's, yeah, so those transitions, sort of dude. That transition from cool dad to straight dad, seem to be they're more like leaps, aren't they? And you don't see what's gone on for him to make that happen.
Mm-hmm. I saw Ethan Hawke.
Did you?
I did. I didn't get to make it to his documentary that he made, but I saw him walk past me twice, and he's a very good-looking person in real life.
All right.
Just in case anyone was wondering.
Well, that's good to know. And he's got a new film, Predestination, an Australian movie, which opens in a couple of weeks, which we will be talking about on this show. Boyhood, yeah, that's it. I really, really wanted to love it. But you know what? I was more emotionally moved by the two-minute trailer than I was by the nearly 3 hours of the film. Unfortunately, it's you know, it's the same length as Transformers, the new Transformer film. Yeah. So, and that's another thing. I do think that perhaps it could have been shorter, and that it would have been very, very difficult after 12 years to be ruthless enough to want to cut some of the stuff that would have meant a lot to the filmmakers emotionally. Do you know what I mean? I wonder whether it's just whether the thing was disciplined enough, and whether it might have just been a little bit better, shorter. But who knows? Look, Boyhood, do you think you can come up with two words for that? I'm going to try and come up with mine while you're thinking.
My two-word review for Boyhood is loving exercise.
All right. That's very, very good. Well done. Mine are life lessons.
Oh. Nice.
All right. That, ladies and gentlemen, is our show for this week. Next week, well, we've got lots to choose from. Opening this weekend in New Zealand, Before I Go to Sleep, starring Nicole Kidman and Colin Firth. And, of course, Housebound gets its New Zealand cinema release this weekend. Again, a huge amount of social media attention and media attention from all of the people involved in that. We will be talking about that one on the show next week, and you know, maybe we'll try and get somebody else into from the film to have an interview or two with them. Who knows? Kaylee, next week, where will you be?
Next week, I will have just landed in Toronto, so I'll be going to the Toronto International Film Festival for the last 4 days, and I'll be in Toronto for 2 weeks before returning to Vancouver and going to the Vancouver Film Festival and spending some quality time with my family.
All right, and in the interim, you are in Chicago this week, so what's on your agenda?
Today I might do the architectural tour by boat. It's cloudy and it's sort of raining on and off today, but it's a bit too hot to wear a raincoat. So I'm just going to decide what I'm going to do with the rest of my day. Tomorrow night I'm going to go to the Gene Siskel Film Center to catch the Congress, because I missed that at NZIF, unfortunately, because thankfully it was sold out for every screening, but I had to miss it. And then I have a list of a friend of mine just moved to Chicago. And unfortunately, he's in New York. He's on a school trip. But he's given me a list of things to do while I'm here. So I'm going to do all the things that I've been sent on this list, including going to Wicker Park. I picked up the pamphlet for the Dark Knight tour. It's a walking tour. You just like walk around and, you know, so I'll take photos of all the Dark Knight places, I guess.
Because one of the weird things about those Dark Knight films is that actually, if you watch them all as a trilogy, you realize that he basically moves from Chicago to New York without anybody mentioning it.
Yeah.
Well, look, I can't wait to find out more about what your week in Chicago has been. And which day is Bacon Day?
Oh, that's on the 6th, I think. I need to look into that. I'm pretty sure I need to go back to Union Station for that one. But yeah, I've been a bit discombobulated, because like any film festival, you just work and you go to movies and you don't sleep, you don't do anything, you just live the festival. So I've been living the festival life for 2 festivals in a row, so I need to sort of sit down and plan out what I'm going to do now that I'm actually on holiday.
All right. If you've enjoyed this episode, you know you can subscribe at funeralsandsnakes.net/Rancho Notorious, where you'll find a way to communicate with us either via email, or you can make a comment on the site. We're now live in the iTunes store, so please give us ratings and reviews, and that all helps other people from around the world discover the show. Our iPhone and Android apps are done, but they're not listed on the site. We'll get around to that this weekend. I want to apologize for the lack of progress on that stuff, but this week is production and deadline week for my other job, and so today we're signing off a magazine. Once that's gone, I will be able to get on to all of this. You can follow us. Oh, no, you're doing social media. What am I doing your job for you?
You can follow us podcast.
We'll
be speaking about things we think are interesting.
Whoa, 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 whoa. Hold on a second there. For some reason, Skype's just carked itself. We might ask you to repeat that, if that's right.
Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yes.
Okay. You can follow us on Twitter at Rancho Podcast. That's RANCHO Podcast, all one word, where we will be tweeting slightly more incessantly than previously about things we think are interesting. And you can interact with us on Letterboxd too. Username is Rancho Notorious.
All right. The show is a Funerals and Snakes production. Season 1 is executive produced by Robert Cato, Random Films, Claire Queray, Mark Cuby, Anthony S. Pratt, Fred Thompson, and Matthew Buchanan. The theme music was Ennio Morricone's The Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, The Lost Plantronics version. You can buy that at the iTunes store, and we're going to play you out with some more music. This is Family of the Year and Hero from Linklater's Boyhood, and we should make a decision, Kaylee, whether we're going to do HBO length seasons or standard network seasons. What do you reckon? Should we start season should we go to 13 and then start season 2? It's tough, isn't it?
It is tough.
It's possibly the most important decision you will make today. Let me know what you think.
I want to go with 18. I like nice 18 episodes.
Oh my god.
It's like an album, you know?
All right, 18 episodes it is. It's just so weird. I'd also want to make special thanks to my partner Karen, who makes sure that everyone who visits us here at Rancho Notorious feel particularly well fed. This is a breakfast show, so just me here at the moment. Thanks very much to Kaylee in Chicago. Thanks to you all for listening. That's good night from me, Dan Slevin.
And good afternoon from me, Kaylee in Chicago.